From Iowa Public Radio News, I'm Ben Kiefer. This is The Exchange. With the June primaries just 2 weeks away, we'll hear from two Republican leaders today. In the first half hour, a conversation with former U.S. House Speaker Newt Gingrich. Gingrich will be in Iowa Wednesday evening as the keynote speaker at the Republican Polk County dinner. Then in our second half hour, we'll be joined by Iowa Senator Charles Grassley. We'll find out why he was one of four Republican senators to break ranks last week and vote for the most extensive financial reform legislation since the Great Depression. Also, his thoughts on the latest cleanup efforts in the Gulf, oil rig regulation, and a preview of confirmation hearings for Elena Kagan. First, this news. This is The Exchange from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. With the June primaries just 2 weeks away, we'll hear from two Republican leaders today. Later, we'll be joined by Iowa Senator Charles Grassley, and we'll find out why he was one of four Republican senators to break ranks last week and vote for the most extensive financial reform legislation since the Great Depression. Also, his thoughts on the latest cleanup efforts in the Gulf, oil rig regulation, and a preview of confirmation hearings for Elena Kagan. But first, we're joined by former U.S. House Speaker Newt Gingrich. Gingrich will be in Iowa Wednesday evening as the keynote speaker at the Republican Polk County dinner. Mr. Gingrich, what will be your message for Iowa Republicans when you come on Wednesday?
Well, look, I'm really looking forward to being in Cedar Rapids and Waterloo and Des Moines for three different events on Wednesday. And basically, my message is going to be that we have to move the country back to a policy of limited spending, lower taxes, more support for family farms, for small businesses, for entrepreneurs, that we need to recognize that unless we focus on job creation, competing with China and India, we're not going to get job creation. And when you look at the threat that we have today, I mean, it's very sobering to realize that right now, this administration has the worst unemployment record since the Great Depression, and they don't seem to even understand that creating jobs is their highest value and their most important activity.
But with unemployment as a lagging economic indicator, is it really only this administration's doing?
Well, look, I would say it differently. I think that you have to look at the question with Greece beginning to collapse, with the scale of the problem we're seeing all around the world in terms of the economies, I'm worried that we could have a second dip rather than a recovery. Now, what you've seen so far as a recovery under Obama is a function of having borrowed and spent several trillion dollars. And that's a kind of artificial stimulant, like taking a drug to enhance your performance for a brief period of time. But in the long run, that's not permanent growth, and that really worries me that we may be adopting a series of policies that actually make it less likely for us to be successful.
Mr. Gingrich, I'd like to turn to the June primaries just 2 weeks away. In your view, what do Iowa Republicans have to do to make an impact at the polls?
Well, I think Iowa Republicans should focus on who can best solve the problems that we're faced with. In my new book, To Save America, I really try to emphasize that this is a unique period. I can't remember a time when we've had as many large fundamental problems facing us as a country, facing Iowa, facing the state by state, all 50 states. And so I would hope that they would really ask the question, whether they're sending people to Washington or they're sending people to Des Moines, who can really help take the lead in making sure that we solve problems and that we apply sound principles to trying to create a better future? Because I think we are faced with some very, very significant problems.
I don't know how much you focused your attention on the Iowa congressional seats, but do you view any of the U.S. House seats in Iowa as especially vulnerable?
Well, yeah, I think that there's a chance for a pickup in Iowa.
Which district would that be?
But I think largely around Des Moines, but I don't know.
That would be the third district, Leonard Boswell's district?
Yeah, I think that Boswell probably is at a point where it's pretty hard for him to defend his record given everything that's happened, and he's going to have to come home with a voting record of raising taxes and keeping power in Washington in a way that I think most Iowans will not be very comfortable with.
Boswell has been targeted as vulnerable in past races, and he has stayed in office. What do you think is the best tact for Republicans to unseat him this time?
Well, I don't think you can beat Boswell as a person. I mean, he's a nice man, and he's very pleasant. But I think you can say to people, do you want to send the signal to keep raising taxes, centralizing power in Washington, and undermining our economy? Or do you want a new approach that controls spending, gets power out of Washington, and creates a much better environment for us to create jobs? And I think that's what the burden that Boswell is going to carry is that big government and high taxes and big bureaucracy are really not where the country's future is. And again, I try to outline in To Save America that there's a really deep choice here. It's not, you know, it's not whether the person's pleasant or not pleasant. It's a question of where would they take America, and can we afford that kind of leadership?
How would you size up the GOP's prospects for retaking the House this November?
Oh, I think it's at least 50-50. I think that when you get to September and October, and we're still looking at very, very high, historically unprecedented unemployment rates, we're looking at an enormous deficit that's going to get worse. We're looking at an Obamacare legislation that every week there's a new report that it's more expensive. All these different things compound, and I think the burden the Democrats are going to carry this fall is of having just a significant record of failure. They can't control the border. They can't clean up the oil problem in the Gulf. They're unable to get the bureaucracies to work effectively. They are all the money they're pouring in, I think, in the end, is just going to be lost. It's like watching somebody with a credit card for the first time. They're spending trillions of dollars. And I think that we have to recognize that our young Americans, a 20-year-old in Iowa today, will work in their working lifetime, will spend twice as much of their tax money paying for interest on their parents' debt at the federal level as they will spend on national security. Now that should be unconscionable. That is just fundamentally bad policy.
Yeah, but only a small portion of that debt was created under the Obama administration, a lot of it under Republican administrations.
Oh, no. Look, by the time Obama's done, the current projections are he's going to add $10 trillion to the debt. That more than doubles it. I mean, the current projections by the Congressional Budget Office, the Obama administration, if they last 8 years, will more than double the total national debt to the highest share of gross domestic product in peacetime ever in American history. In fact, higher than it was at the end of World War II.
You're projecting budgets that haven't even been done, and there hasn't been a reelection of President Obama. That's interesting, though.
No, I'm simply projecting what the Congressional, I'm telling you what the Congressional Budget Office said about his plans and about the Congress's plans. And in part, that's what Boswell has to go home and defend, is that this is a Congress which has been spending money like crazy. And every time they turn around, they have a new expenditure.
My guest, if you just joined us, is former U.S. House Speaker Newt Gingrich. He'll be in Iowa on Wednesday speaking at several events. A lot of comparisons, Mr. Gingrich, you've heard between 1994 and 2010. How much like or unlike 1994 when you engineered a GOP takeover of the House?
Well, I think that there is some comparison, but I wouldn't overstate it. I think that the Republicans are probably slightly weaker today than they were in 94, but the Democrats are much weaker. I think the economy is much worse today. I think the radicalism of the Obama administration is much greater than the Clinton administration. Clinton, in many ways, tried to be a moderate liberal. Obama clearly represents the Saul Alinsky a kind of radicalism out of Chicago that is it makes him far and away the most radical president in American history. All of those things create a backdrop for a very vivid choice this fall, whether the country wants to move, as I say in my book To Save America, whether the country wants to move towards market-oriented, decentralized, local government-controlled activities, or the country wants to move towards bureaucratic politician systems of centralized activity in Washington. And I think no president has given us as decisive a choice as Obama has.
The subtitle of your book, To Save America, is Stopping Obama's Secular Socialist Machine. And specifically, the threat that you see is?
Well, I mean, start with the word machine. These guys came out of Chicago. They understand what machines are like. They got $787 billion in spending in a stimulus package that no member of Congress had read. Now, even the Chicago City Council would have found that an amazing achievement. They had the entire country opposed to them on health care. They couldn't hold town hall meetings because they were so hostile. Every national poll for 4 months said the country was opposed to Obamacare. In the one big referendum in Massachusetts, the Republican Scott Brown won by running against Obamacare. So Senator Kennedy's seat went to a Republican over the issue of health reform. Faced with all of that information, they rammed it through anyway. Now, that's the behavior of a machine. They're clearly socialist. AIG, the largest insurance company, is now run by the government. General Motors and Chrysler are now run by the government. And in the process, the government took money away from creditors and bondholders and gave it to the union allies, you know, in violation of all bankruptcy law proceedings. They have nationalized a student loan program, so it's now being run by a government bureaucracy. They have something like 90% of all housing mortgages are now held by Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, two giant government-sponsored enterprises that are actually more in debt than all the major banks combined. This is clearly an administration. The president goes around the country and announces he gets to decide how much you ought to be able to earn. He'll tell you if you're earning too much, which is very, very unlike the American tradition. And they're clearly secular. I mean, look at the Democrat who ran for the U.S. Senate in Massachusetts, who said if you're a Catholic, maybe you shouldn't work in emergency rooms because your values are wrong. Look at the judge who said that a national day of prayer was unconstitutional. Look at the judge that Obama nominated who said that the Indiana legislature should not be allowed to say to have a prayer at the beginning of their session. Or look at the decision just this last week by the National Park Service that they couldn't put the cross back up in the Mojave Desert, even though the Supreme Court had ruled it was okay, because they were using a technicality to avoid doing it. I mean, every time you turn around, these are people who believe in bigger government, more redistribution of what you earn, more control by the politicians, and who seek to drive God out of public life because it inhibits their ability to reshape the society.
Coming up, more of my conversation with former U.S. House Speaker Newt Gingrich. Gingrich will be in Iowa this week with political stops planned for Cedar Rapids, Waterloo, and Des Moines. Gingrich will be the keynote speaker at the first annual Rob Kelly Victory Club dinner Wednesday night at the Marriott Hotel in downtown Des Moines. Also, on the second half of our program today, a conversation with U.S. Senator Charles Grassley of Iowa. During the second half of the program, we'll take your phone calls as well. We'll ask Senator Grassley why he was one of the four Republican senators to break ranks with his party last week and vote for the most extensive financial reform legislation since the Great Depression. We'll also ask Senator Grassley's thoughts on the latest cleanup efforts from the oil spill in the Gulf, plus about the confirmation hearings for Supreme Court nominee Elena Kagan. This is The Exchange from Iowa Public Radio News. Welcome back to The Exchange from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. During the first half hour, my conversation with former U.S. House Speaker Newt Gingrich. He'll be in Iowa this week with political stops planned for Cedar Rapids, Waterloo, and Des Moines. Gingrich will be the keynote speaker at the first annual Rob Kelly Victory Club dinner Wednesday night at the Marriott Hotel in downtown Des Moines. So now let's get back to my conversation with former House Speaker Gingrich. Before the break, the former speaker was lamenting the fact that the current Obama administration and the Democratic majority are seeking, in his words, to drive God out of public life because it is hindering what Mr. Gingrich says is the left's ability to reshape society. Aren't non-Christians, atheists, or agnostics in any way lesser Americans?
No. They're not lesser Americans, but they don't get to dictate to the rest of us what their values are. The idea that the overwhelming majority of Americans believe it's okay to have prayer.
But I don't think that atheists, agnostics, or non-Christians are dictating it. I think they might interpret it as Christians dictating it where there should be, or at least there is an idea that there's a separation between government and religion.
None of the founding fathers would have found saying a prayer at a graduation threatening. None of the founding fathers would have found putting up a cross in the middle of the Mojave Desert threatening. The idea that, none of the founding fathers, including Lincoln, who is not a founding father but who wrote the phrase, would find one nation under God inappropriate. This is a fundamental distinction about the nature of America. How do you explain a country which, whose primary political document, the Declaration of Independence, says we are endowed by our Creator with certain unalienable rights? And how are you going to explain that to kids if you're not allowed to describe what Creator means?
Well, what about the Americans who fled England, who fled religious persecution to practice whatever faith they wanted to?
Well, I didn't say that an atheist couldn't practice a non-faith if they wanted to. I said what they can't do is dictate to the rest of us, the society at large we want to live in. They can't drive God out of public life. They can't say, no, you can't teach American history accurately because I don't want you to say the word Creator.
Mr. Gingrich, you refer to, in your new book, to President Obama's secular socialist machine representing as great a threat to America as Nazi Germany or the Soviet Union once did. You received a great deal of criticism for that comparison, even from some in your own party. Don't you think it's, even as Fox News's Chris Wallace put it, wildly over the top to equate the Obama administration with Nazi Germany?
I didn't equate them. What I said was that just as it was a decisive threat to the survival of liberty as we have known it, I think that the victory of a secular socialist machine fundamentally changes America in ways that will make it unrecognizable to most Americans. And I think that that's just technically correct.
And that it's as great a threat to America as Nazi Germany.
I think that the danger we faced of losing America to foreign enemies and the danger we faced in the Civil War of losing America through disruption is very similar to the danger we face today. If you are an American who believes in the classic American system, if you believe that your rights come from your Creator, if you believe in the work ethic, if you believe that you ought to be allowed to keep the money that you earn, then I think this system is a direct threat to the very survival of the values you believe in.
Yeah, but it's interesting. You won't repeat the phrase that you wrote, that it's as big a threat to America as Nazi Germany or the Soviet Union once was.
Well, I'm happy to repeat. I think whether you want to describe Nazi Germany, the Soviet Union, you want to describe the disruption of the Civil War, I think that these were threats which would have ended America as we have known it. And I believe that if you have a continued driving force that wants to fundamentally center power in Washington, give politicians and bureaucrats control over your life, drive God out of all public discussion, I think the America you end up with is radically different than anything we have been in the last 400 years, and it is in that sense a decisive threat to America's future.
Polling data suggests that the majority of voters want an end to the partisan rancor we've had so many years, want leaders who bring the country together instead of making the divisions even greater, Mr. Gingrich. Do you share that vision of the U.S.? And I'm wondering how this book, Stopping Obama's Secular Socialist Machine, contributes to uniting rather than dividing.
I think it's remarkable that after a year and a half of a president who has consciously and systematically and deliberately been partisan, whose every effort to ram through a stimulus package with no Republican votes in the House, to ram through the health bill with no Republican votes in the House or the Senate, who has routinely broken his pledge about transparency, to then turn and say to us, "Oh gosh, why aren't you guys being bipartisan?"
I wasn't quoting President Obama. I was reflecting polling data that says that most
right.
Americans want there to be less rancor, more unity in our politics.
Look, I would love to get to that place, and I'm very happy to try to get to that place. When we passed welfare reform, half the Democrats voted with us. When we balanced the federal budget, the president signed it, and we had a bipartisan signing ceremony. I'm very willing to participate in bipartisan activities, but I don't think you can have bipartisan activities if one side is acting in a way which fundamentally threatens the core values of the American people. And I think I don't quite understand how you would expect us to be able to achieve that kind of unity when you have a group of people in Washington today who are acting in ways that are, I think, very destructive of America's future.
How do you respond to the accusation that statements like the ones that are connected with your latest book, Secular Socialist Machine, references to Nazi Germany or the Soviet Union in the same sentence with the Obama administration, that these statements from you are more about selling newspapers, ad time, than truly reflecting the vision of America?
Well, I'd ask you to do, and I'd ask our listeners to do, take a look at my book, To Save America. Look at the phrase secular socialist machine. Watch what's going on in Washington, and then you decide. If in fact, it is a system moving steadily towards a more secular America, then I'm right. If it's a system moving steadily towards a more socialist, big government, big bureaucracy, politician-defined America, then I'm right. If it behaves like a machine, I mean, the story that you had yesterday where Admiral Sestak said he was offered a job in the federal government if he'd drop out of the race in Pennsylvania, which, by the way, is a felony. That's kind of the behavior of a machine. So if the three words are right, if it turns out, by the way, this is a secular socialist machine, then using the words is simply clarity, which may make some people uncomfortable, but in fact is factually defensible.
What signals, Mr. Gingrich, are you looking for to declare your candidacy for 2012?
Oh, we're not worrying about that. Clist and I will discuss that in February and March of next year. We are currently totally focused on trying to win the election this fall, and we think it's very important to see if we can't maximize the number of House and Senate seats and the number of governors and state legislatures that we can pick up this year, and we have lots of time to worry about 12.
You referenced your wife there. She's a graduate of Luther College in Iowa, isn't she?
Yeah, she went to spend 4 very happy years in Decorah, Iowa, and she really treasures her memories and likes to go back there regularly, and I've been with her several times, so I've had a great chance to get to know Decorah better.
Mr. Gingrich, I want to thank you very much for this conversation.
Thank you. It's been an enjoyable talk.
Coming up next, a conversation with U.S. Senator Charles Grassley of Iowa. We will take your phone calls as we explore the latest cleanup efforts from the oil spill in the Gulf. Plus, we'll ask the senator about the financial reform bill he voted for last week and about the confirmation hearings for Supreme Court nominee Elena Kagan. The number to participate in the conversation, 1-866-780-9100, 1-866-780-9100, or you can email us at theexchange@iowapublicradio.org. Straight ahead, U.S. Senator Charles Grassley. This is The Exchange from Iowa Public Radio News. Back with The Exchange from Iowa Public Radio News, I'm Ben Kiefer, and with the June primaries just 2 weeks ago, 2 weeks away, rather, we're hearing from a couple of Republican leaders today. Earlier, we heard a conversation I had with former U.S. House Speaker Newt Gingrich, and now we're joined by Iowa Senator Charles Grassley, live by phone. Good afternoon, Senator Grassley.
Well, I'm always glad to be with you, Ben. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Now, last Thursday, against strong Republican opposition, the Senate passed its version of the financial reform bill by a vote of 59-39. You were one of only 4 Republican senators to break ranks with your party, vote for what is being called the most extensive financial reform legislation since the Great Depression. What was the basis of your decision to vote for the bill and also to break ranks with your party?
Yeah. I want to, well, first of all, there wasn't any breaking ranks with the party because there wasn't any party position that had to be taken. Each person was free to vote their own desires as they saw the bill, good or bad for constituents. I saw it very good for my constituents because it provided federal transparency for the Federal Reserve System. For the first time, we're having a government accountability office audit the Federal Reserve System. There's too much secrecy in the Federal Reserve System. Transparency brings accountability. Now, that follows on something that I got done on a lesser basis for the Fed back in at the housing bill a year ago. Then we also had provisions that ended the security and exchange revolving door, you know, where people work for the government one day and then go work for the industry the next day. That's a bad thing to happen with the Security and Exchange Commission. And then we got further whistleblower protections in it, particularly for credit rating agencies, employees, like I was able to do about 10 years ago on the Enron legislation that passed, and also conflicts of interest in credit rating agencies. And then we were able to keep out of the bill something that was in the bill. We amended it out on an amendment I got adopted, 75-21, for having not having politically appointed inspectors generals. And then also we did away with too-big-to-fail $50 billion fund that was in it, and I thought that was very important. And I don't know how many more reasons you wanted me to state, but I think I'll stop there tell you that's why I voted for it.
Let me ask you this. Are you absolutely certain this will stop any sort of abusive banking practices in the future?
Well, I'm sure that in the 1990s when we passed some legislation, and again in 2001 when Sarbanes-Oxley was passed, there was a feeling this may fix it, but this is a very comprehensive bill, so let's hope it does. But, you know, with every piece of legislation, there's going to be somebody around the world or in the United States that finds some way with the imprecision of the English language and the statutory language that comes in legislation, find some way of getting around something. But one of the biggest things that created the bubble, the lack of registration of derivatives, now is covered by this legislation. And I think that that's a very important thing that was behind the bubble that burst 2 years ago. So I think from that standpoint, it's going to be more effective because you'll have transparency of derivatives. But there's one thing not included that makes it very difficult for me to promise you that this bill is 100% effective, and that is the fact that Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac were not included, and I would say that they are only second to Wall Street, a major reason why we had the bubble that burst that brought us to the recession we're in. So I voted two or three times. Well, maybe I better say at least once for the McCain Amendment that would have included Freddie and Fannie, but the Democrats didn't want those included. So obviously one of the major vacuums in this bill is the fact that Fannie and Freddie operate outside of this system.
Senator, critics, they're mostly Republicans and financial groups. Critics of this bill say it would be almost punitive, that they contend it would overregulate the financial industry and stall the flow of capital that makes our economy go. You don't think there's a danger, I guess, that this may put the brakes on the financial industry and the economy as well?
There is some overreach in the bill, but I think most of the overreach in the bill comes from the new agency called the Consumer Finance Protection Agency. And there's no doubt that the consumers are entitled to more transparency and more protection. But I think that you got to think in terms of the overreach. The overreach that comes from maybe including making four payments to an orthodontist or four payments here or there, because it covers any financial transaction that has four or more payments. So it seems to me like that's going a little bit too far. But when you stop to think of the situation that we're in, I think that that the bill does more good than harm.
Senator Charles Grassley is our guest for the remainder of the hour. Senator Grassley with us. If you'd like to ask a question of Senator Grassley, 1-866-780-9100, or email us, theexchange@iowapublicradio.org. I've read some analysts, Senator Grassley, again with this financial reform bill, that have a more cynical take on it, that one of the reasons you decided with the Democrats in this case was because of political pressure here in Iowa. For instance, a research poll, 2000 poll published earlier this month, shows Democratic challenger Roxanne Conlin trailing by only 9 points, you getting less than 50% of the vote in a hypothetical matchup. Did pressure from your constituency influence your decision so you're not to be seen on the side of Wall Street, but rather on Main Street's side?
Well, for sure, this bill sends a very strong message to Wall Street that it's not business as usual. But a long time before I had any Democrat opponents, I was telling my town meetings, and don't forget I have a town meeting in every county every year, and I've done that for all the years I've been in the Senate, so, you know, I keep in touch. I was telling my constituents that one of the things we absolutely needed that we didn't have, and the reason for the bubble outside of Freddie and Fannie, is transparency, and this bill brings transparency. I think that's very, very important. So, you know, people can say whatever they want to, but I can tell you what I've been saying for a year right now, and that is it's a matter of accountability and transparency, and I think transparency brings accountability. And I've been looking, I think I proved that I've been looking out for the taxpayers ever since the massive bailout began. Mm-hmm. And I can tell you, I already told you about one instance, the Special Inspectors General. Well, I guess I didn't mention that one, so let me mention for the first time, setting up Special Inspectors General for the bailout. And then I did mention earlier in this program that I am an advocate for Government Accountability Office for the first time auditing the Federal Reserve System, because there's too much secrecy there. In other words, my position for a long period of time has been that long period of time is that the public's business ought to be public. So I'm standing up to the Treasury Department again, and again, it all amounts to transparency and accountability.
Okay, Senator Grassley, let's go to our phones, 1-866-780-9100. Rebecca is joining us from Des Moines. Good afternoon, Rebecca.
Hi. I just want to ask Senator Grassley about the party of no. I'm wondering, I'm very disturbed by the fact that most Republicans vote as a bloc, and they have decided to not vote for anything at all, really, and they have, in my opinion, become the party of no. Why cannot Senator Grassley take a leadership position and convince more Republicans to evaluate various bills and laws that are up for vote and convince people to use their brains and use their ability to read and write and stop voting as a party of no? I'll take my answer off the air.
Thank you, Rebecca.
And I thank you for that opportunity, because here's where we are. Obviously, we are the party of no, K-N-O-W. We know that you can't triple the national debt over a period of 10 years, as the last budget does. We know that you should not nationalize General Motors. We know that should not say that a stimulus bill is going to keep unemployment under 8%, and that you can't spend yourself into prosperity. We know that cap and trade is going to export jobs to China if we don't have a worldwide agreement instead of just doing it in the United States and putting a tax on energy in this country so we don't have manufacturing.
Senator Grassley, if I may, though, I think Rebecca's question was why you said in this last vote, for instance, you broke ranks was not accurate, but in the earlier healthcare debate, for instance, when you're asked sometimes to vote as a bloc by your party, why you have to do that rather than, as you seem to have described in this last vote, vote what's best for your constituents and for your conscience.
Well, then, let me clarify for you that we have never had a caucus of the Republican Party that had uniform voting that we were told that we had to vote a certain way. So if you're spreading the propaganda that Republicans meet as a caucus and put pressure on everybody to vote that way, that is entirely wrong. I've never been in a caucus like that. And here's what you want to think about.
I wasn't spreading the propaganda, Senator.
The
I was simply trying to clarify your question.
And that health care bill was a bill that we thought ought to be bipartisan, and then the White House pulled the rug out from under the vote. Mm-hmm. So I think you got to think in terms of our votes being the way I see my constituency is. And that's what I get from my town meetings.
Okay. I was simply trying to help clarify what I thought was Rebecca's question. If we could talk quickly about the BP oil spill in the Gulf, Senator. BP has repeatedly said it would pay all legitimate claims resulting from the oil spill in the Gulf of Mexico. It, of course, raises the question, what exactly does legitimate claim mean? What are you doing to make sure that we taxpayers are not left holding the bag?
Well, I think existing law makes sure that the taxpayers aren't left holding the bag, because when it comes to environmental damage, that is entirely the obligation of BP or any other oil company that might do it. When it comes to economic damage, there's a $10 million limit on that now, but that's going to be very dramatically increased. And I said 10 million. I'm wrong. It's I just now remembered 75 million. But that's very, very inadequate. And so consequently, Congress is going to look at very dramatically raising that figure. But the bill has not been presented out of the committee yet.
Mm-hmm. What kind of turning point does this spill mark in the way we regulate offshore oil rigs?
There's only one thing that I can say right now for sure, because the administration has admitted this, and they are changing, and I compliment them for changing. They're reorganizing the government agency that is responsible for that. Second thing is, that something that we've got to make sure is changed for the future. And we've got to make sure that these fail-safe mechanisms that are at the ocean floor that failed in this particular instance, that they're more fail-safe. And so we've got to do that. And then a top priority is to, right now, is to do everything we can to get the well capped. But the obviously, the government isn't involved in that. That's the responsibility of BP, and it's clear from this accident that neither BP or the regulators were prepared for it. BP has admitted of certain faults, and the president has already admitted regulation came up short by changing. By changing the department, or they're in the process of doing that.
How satisfied are you with the Obama administration's reaction to the spill?
I believe that that they have done all they can do. Or, I mean, in other words, they responded with all they could do, but then obviously they're still going to continue to do what they can do and do more. when they have the opportunity.
Mm-hmm. And improve the stronger oversight of regulators, for instance.
Well, I think that they admitted a shortcoming there by the reorganization that they're doing. And maybe you can hold Congress somewhat responsible, because we have oversight responsibilities to make the laws that are faithfully executed. You know, that's our oversight responsibility. We spend all of our time talking about legislation. We don't spend enough time on oversight. So the Energy and the Environment Committees probably should have been on top of that to a greater extent.
Senator Grassley, we only have about 5 minutes left, and I wanted to certainly get to newest Supreme Court nominee, Elena Kagan. Her confirmation hearings are set to begin at the end of June. The chair of the Senate Judiciary Committee, Senator Patrick Leahy, is in charge of that. You are on a longtime member of the Senate Judiciary Committee. What kinds of questions do you plan to ask Elena Kagan? What most concerns you?
Well, we kind of get into a position of reviewing her papers before we decide what kind of questions we ask her. I can tell you what would be foremost in my mind that I might ask her, but I'm not sure that I want to be held to these questions that I'm going to ask, but I'm always concerned about how she sees the False Claims Act, because that's a bill that I sponsored, and to some extent, Supreme Courts have neutered, to some extent, my legislation that's brought $22 billion back into the federal treasury. I'm usually concerned about how Supreme Court justices view the 10th Amendment, to a lesser extent, the 9th Amendment, the 5th Amendment on property rights, and the 2nd Amendment on gun rights.
What about the question of so-called judicial activism?
Well, that is a 50,000-foot question. I was trying to answer the 10,000-foot question.
Okay.
Without a doubt, I'm looking for people on the court who are dispassionate, leave their personal views out of it. I think the president, when he says he's looking for somebody that can be empathetic or express empathy, that's putting personal views into it. I expect a justice to look at the Constitution and the law and those words and do what we call judicial restraint. You can say it's being dispassionate. You can say it's like Lady Justice being blindfolded, looking at just the law and being very impartial.
Iowa farmers enjoyed one of their best years in 2008 thanks to soaring corn and soybean prices, and I wanted to get to this because, Senator Grassley, I know you were a farmer. Now many growers are getting a second shot of cash for the 2008 crops in the form of federal disaster payments, even if they had minimal revenue losses. Some farmers are getting as much as $100,000 each, total statewide $163 million, more than twice that of any other state so far, and they say the state's total could top $300 million. Experts, though, say that because of quirks in how the payments are calculated, some of the income losses that the disaster aid is supposed to cover existed largely on paper. So what is your reaction, especially as a farmer, but also as a senator, of course, that more than covering real damage and loss, it's turned out to be a bonus of taxpayer dollars for some farmers?
Yeah. Well, I haven't read that, so I can't comment on it. But this was a program that set up a trust fund for the first time for disaster assistance, so that farmers would not have to worry about would Congress come along and pass a law after the disaster, as opposed to making sure that the money was available, putting farmers less in a position of being dependent upon the exigencies of a political decision made in Washington, and that's the first time. But you also got to remember, we put in a requirement that you had to have crop insurance in order to qualify for this program, and you want to remember that this is due to the floods that we had in Iowa in 2008.
We have just a minute left, so I'd ask you to keep it brief, but the primary is coming up in 2 weeks. How do you gauge the mood of the electorate in Iowa?
I think that the mood of the electorate in Iowa is very similar to what has been expressed in other states in primaries, that people are very concerned about what's going on in Washington. The one thing that I hear, two words would express what I hear from a lot of Iowans, I'm scared, and I think it refers mostly to the big spending going on in Washington, maybe starting under the Bush administration because Republicans were kicked out in the 2006 election. There's still that there, and people are scared of the legacy of debt that we're leaving to our children and grandchildren, and they think our America is not going to be as strong economically and in a world leadership position as we've been.
Senator Grassley, we've run out of time. We do want to make sure we thank you very much for making time for us.
Well, I've enjoyed the conversation very much, and particularly for the one person that called in.
Very good. The Exchange is produced by Catherine Perkins, Jeff Schmidt, and Alex Hoyer. Production assistance today from Christoph Mai. Technical support from Dennis Reese, rather Alex Hoyer today. Podcasting and on-demand audio of The Exchange available at iowapublicradio.org. Our theme music was composed and performed by Dan Knight. The Exchange is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.